What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Headaches in Collegiate Athletes. This week, our guest is Dr. Tad Seifert, and joining me right here in the show, or in the studio, is Miss Kathy Shupa. Kathy, say hello.
Hello.
All right, welcome to the show. This conversation is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches. So you can see the article that Dr. Seifert is going to be talking about. If you go to sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches, and it'll have links, ways to contact Kathy, ways to contact Dr. Seifert as well. So without much further ado, Dr. Seifert, welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. So we wanted to discuss your article that's just out online. It's about to be out in print about headaches in collegiate athletes. Why don't you give us, just get us started talking about the article.
About 3 years ago, Dr. Brian Hainline, who's currently the chief medical officer of the NCAA to head up the NCAA's headache task force, which is a new venture. Dr. Hainline, to his credit, has been very forward-thinking in trying to identify areas within the collegiate athlete of which we know very little from an evidence-based standpoint. Interestingly enough, headache in general is one of those areas. And it's not just the area of headaches associated with head trauma, which obviously has gotten the lion's share of media attention over the last many years, but also as primary headaches, such as migraine headaches, such as tension-type headaches, and then other types of headaches common in the layperson, like sinus headache. And when you look back through the medical literature, there has really been very little published in the way of evidence-based publication specific to headache. This phase one of what we did with the NCAA Headache Task Force was we simply tried to get a better handle on what the prevalence of different types of headache disorders are within this unique population of individual, i.e. the competitive NCAA athlete.
All right. So can I keep going with that? Just what are some of the things you guys looked at? And then I'll have some questions once you talk a little bit more about how you guys did the study. So
the way that we designed this study is it's a retrospective cross-sectional survey study, which inherently has its own limitations. You know, there's recall bias that comes along with any type of retrospective survey. Just being a form of a questionnaire has its own inherent limitations. You know, bottom line, there are a number of limitations to the study of which we very much are aware and acknowledge. However, we thought that this was a good place to start just simply because it would be able to give us some good evidence-based data then from which to move forward. So the way this was designed was we identified five Division I member institutions, and those were Western Kentucky University, the University of Kentucky, the University of Pittsburgh, West Virginia University, and Stanford. And each of those institutions, within those sites, we recruited athletes, you know, from the spectrum of contact exposure, all the way from sports that you would expect to have no contact exposure, like track and field, all the way up to true collision sports like football. And these were both male and female in gender. Athletes were simply administered a questionnaire that asked a number of detailed questions specific to their prior headache history. And these were questions such as acknowledging any type of self-reported history of migraine, self-reported history of sinus headache, other types of self-reported headache like tension headache or sinus headache. And we also incorporated into the questionnaire questions regarding their concussion history, specifically self-reported history of diagnosed concussion or concussions in the past. And through that, we were able to establish to some degree, a fairly accurate prevalence of different types of headache disorders within this population of athletes.
Good morning. I really enjoyed reading your study. I just had a couple of questions for the listeners who have not read the study. The number of responses, I was very surprised by the number who had a migraine versus sinus infection, sinus pain, for the total number of responses. And my follow-up question to you was, I didn't see, or maybe I misread in the study, was how many total had a previous head injury, such as a concussion, and how was that related to a follow-up headache?
No, they're all good questions. To look specifically at the numbers, respondents in general, approximately 23% reported or acknowledged a self-reported history of migraine. About a quarter, or about 25%, self-reported a history of sinus headache. Now, that's interesting just in and of itself for a number of reasons. First, specifically with the migraine component, we know that the prevalence of migraine in the general population is anywhere from, dependent upon what source you read, anywhere from about 12 to 18% of the general population, but certainly not as high as the percent number that we observed. So that was an interesting finding that we observed. And then furthermore, when you look at the sinus headache prevalence of 25%, that's also quite interesting because back in 2003, there was a seminal study in the world of headache medicine by Eric DeRoss and at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale. And what they did was they looked at individuals that had presented to a tertiary care or a tertiary headache center with the chief complaint or self-report of, quote, "I have sinus headache," end quote. And when they actually looked at those individuals self-reporting sinus headache and actually applied the International Classification of Headache Disorders criteria, which is really the gold standard in establishing headache diagnoses, when they applied the ICHD criteria to those individuals with the self-report of sinus headache, they found that actually over 80% of those individuals actually fit criteria for migraine, chronic migraine, or probable migraine. So if you were to take that assumed 80% number and apply that to the 25% of our athletes that self-reported a history of sinus headache, you know, and assumed that or factored in perhaps 80% of those actually having migraine rather than sinus headache, the overall prevalence of migraine in our study goes well north of 25%. You know, actually, it would be above 40%. So that number jumped out to us as well. Again, keeping in mind that the overall prevalence of migraine in the general population is closer to 12 to 18%. Those were some big, big numbers that jumped out to us. With regard to the question pertaining to concussion history, we found that our numbers really fell in line with what has been reported in previous studies, with about 10% of our sample reporting a prior history of concussion. But the interesting finding there was that the prevalence of migraine continued to elevate in individuals with a self-reported history of concussion in the past, and continued to elevate even further in those individuals that reported a history or a prior history of multiple concussions. So again, the prevalence of migraine continued to elevate from those with no prior history of concussion to elevating further with those with a prior history of one concussion to elevating even further to those with a prior history of multiple concussion.
That is very, very interesting. Would you say that because you looked at collegiate athletes, you know, the setting that Jeremy and I are in is a, you know, the high school setting. Even furthermore, I deal with a lot of intermediate athletes as well in the same school district that Jeremy is working in. Would you say that the age of the athlete doing the reporting the younger the athlete, have you seen that the prevalence of the symptoms of migraines has a bearing on that, or would the migraines become more significant as they become older?
No, and that's a good question. And actually, here in Louisville, it's been about 2 years ago now, myself and my nurse practitioner, Victoria Shipman, she and I had presented a poster at the, it was the 2015 American Academy of Neurology's Sports Concussion Conference. And we simply applied this same questionnaire that we had administered, you know, in this paper to collegiate level athletes. We had administered that to a subsection of high school football players here in the Louisville community. And again, the very interesting finding there were that the numbers very much were similar to what we found in this population of collegiate level athletes. You know, the big take home points there being that the prevalence of migraine again was significantly higher than what we had expected to find. Secondly, that prevalence of migraine elevated in those high school football players that had reported a history of concussion, and thirdly, continued to elevate even further in those high school football players that had a self-reported history of multiple concussions in their past. So it seemed to follow a very, very similar pattern in that of just high school football players when compared to this population of collegiate level athletes that are reported upon in this paper.
In your practice, are you seeing or do you see post-concussion athletes?
I do. My practice is now exclusively outpatient, and of my practice, probably about 85 to 90% of that anymore is all sports-related head injuries. So this, you know, this truly is what I love to do. Number one, but secondly, it's what I see each and every day, and that's what really was the impetus for me anyway to try to develop a study of this nature, because this really falls in line with what I see on my own clinical experience every day.
Right. I saw in reading your biographical information that you're very involved with boxing in the state of Kentucky. Along those lines, when we do the initial evaluation on baseline testing, no matter what the company is, impact or whatever else, would you say that we need to do a better job, no matter the sport contact that is, of doing a better evaluation of a migraine history, given the data that you and your colleagues found in this study?
I would absolutely argue that to be needed and very much necessary. We didn't get into it in the body of this paper, at least not all that deeply. But we do know in general that individuals with migraine, it has been reported in previous citations, that individuals with migraine seem to be in and of themselves higher risk to be concussed. And we also know that individuals with migraine, once they do sustain a concussion, seem to take longer to return to baseline. And we also know that both of those are true to a lesser degree simply in individuals that don't necessarily have a prior history of migraine, but that do have a family history of migraine. So there's something about the migraine brain which affects how an athlete responds after the injury and during that arc of recovery. You know, and if you wanted to take that even a step further, there have been some authors that have purported that migraine in and of itself be a type of neurodegenerative disease, you know, within the world of neurology. I'm not entirely sold on that, but if we wanted to, for a second, presume that to be true, that migraine in and of itself is a neurodegenerative disorder, you know, is this a subset of contact sport athlete, i.e. the migraineur? Is this a subset of athlete that is even further higher risk for the chronic neurocognitive issues that can occur later in life in these contact and collision sport and combat sport athletes that have continued persistent cumulative level exposures to head trauma. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I think that that's at least the type of questions that we need to be starting to ask ourselves. And, you know, the only way really to answer those types of questions is to start to track the migraine athletes much more, you know, on a much closer basis.
I guess a simple way to ask this question is, over the data that you have seen and the patients you have seen since we started looking at concussions a little bit differently, at least since I've, you know, been in the field of athletic training, you know, since the middle 80s, is do you think that there's a correlation between concussions, migraines, and then maybe early onset dementia?
You know, and I'll be frank, I don't know is my honest answer. There are, however, a small handful of very interesting papers now that migraine is a risk factor for dementia. So if we want to, you know, for the sake of argument, again, assume that that is true, which, again, that's just been through a very small number of research papers thus far. So I'm even hesitant to say at this point in time that that is definitively true. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that's true, that individuals with migraine just in and of themselves are higher risk for dementia. Well, then we take that population of individual that's already at higher risk for dementia and place them in a collision sport like football or a sport like boxing or mixed martial arts that we know without question contributes to a higher risk of this mild cognitive impairment later in life. You know, are those different factors, the migraine and the sport exposure itself, are those perhaps synergistically working toward making that athlete even higher risk for cognitive impairments later in life? Again, there's no data in the way of looking at that in any type of systematic manner. But I think where we are today in 2017, with all of these concerns at hand, I think that it's absolutely imperative that these are the types of questions that we need to be asking and furthermore need to be looking aggressively for the answers.
Well, I'm sorry to put you on the spot. I guess that opens up another study for somebody.
No, for sure. Yeah.
You know, I had a very unique experience, and I don't know if you've seen this before. I don't often think speak of personal experiences, but as a neurologist, if you've seen this before, I had viral meningitis and had severe migraines, following for 6 months after, and actually was a patient of Howard Derman. I'm sure that you know of him in the Houston Medical Center, and was treated by him. They have since, they went away after about 6 months. In your study, did you come across any of your athletes when they did their filling out your survey that the migraines were as a result of something other than a concussion or were not a long-term migraine? Such as meningitis, viral meningitis, or some other cause?
No, and that's a great question. And again, to be quite frank, that was one of the larger limitations of our study, in the sense that we asked, you know, obviously about, and we also asked about history of head trauma, you know, i.e. concussion. Not tell, however, and what we were not able to ascertain through a retrospective study, as this was, you know, was the question: what came first, the chicken or the egg? We were not able to have temporal relationship as to, you know, concussion came first and then migraine, you know, or conversely, we were unable to ascertain did migraine come first and then the concussion. And that's why in our next phase of study, you know, what I'm loosely referring to now as phase two, what we plan to do is take of incoming freshman athlete, you know, and this next phase will not just be Division I. We plan on looking at Division I, Division II, Division III level athletes, but looking at an incoming freshman class and tracking them in the very least 4 or 5 year collegiate level career, but then hopefully to also be able to obtain the funding to track that freshman class even further, you know, another perhaps 5 years out, to see prospectively over the arc of time how, you know, headaches occur, you know, from a temporal relationship timing wise to exposure to head trauma, and not just diagnosed head trauma like concussion, but just simply to exposure to head trauma itself, like you have in some sports like football and lacrosse and ice hockey, and to see, you know, what the relationship is, you know, if at all. But again, in the design of study that we report in this publication, that was just an inherent limitation from which we couldn't really provide any type of true conclusion.
All right. There was a couple comments in your study. One of them was that headache is one of the 10 most disabling restrictions in the U.S. and can lead to overall decrease in quality of life. I know Kathy mentioned this earlier. We have to come up with a better way of tracking or evaluating migraines. And I'm really all about the practical aspect. So how can I, as an athletic trainer, evaluate or look at the high school athlete and determine if they have a migraine, if they need to see somebody else, if the concussion is related only to migraine or to neck pain, you know, cervicogenic type pain. And so how am I going to use your research in my athletic training room?
Yeah, no, and those are good questions. Yeah, and I, you know, really in all the presentations that I've been giving specific to headache, you know, in the last probably 18 months, I've been a huge proponent of pre-participation assessment or pre-participation physical exam to really try to document just some very baseline points with regard to headache history. You know, asking if there is either a personal history of migraine or a family history of migraine. Again, because that's a subset of athlete that I would argue we need to watch and monitor a bit more closely over the arc of especially a contact sports season or a collision sports season. But, you know, again, from a practical standpoint, is reporting headache, number one, throbbing or pulsating in nature, or associated with light or sound sensitivity, or associated with nausea or vomiting, or is just disabling in nature, you know, causing them to miss practice or miss school or miss social functions. There's a very real chance that those are migraine headaches. Tension headaches are not disabling, do not result in lighter sound sensitivity. Sinus headaches, although some would report they're disabling, they generally speaking do not result in significant nausea or vomiting, nor do they result in significant lighter sound sensitivity. Sinus headaches result in exquisite tenderness to palpation over the sinuses, but those other aspects, those other associated symptoms are quite atypical for sinus headache. So if you have an athlete that is presenting to you and reporting those types of symptoms, odds are he has migraine, you know, whether it's been diagnosed in the past or not. In fact, you might, as the athletic trainer, be the first to suggest to them, you know, you might actually have migraine. And in that sense, I always recommend, with the first onset of that type of headache, whether it's in relationship to head trauma exposure or not, that they be seen by, you know, a neurologist with some type of experience within you know, the headache world. And I think even more ideal to that would be a neurologist that has experience not only with headache but also with treating athletes. Because again, you and I both know just from a practical standpoint, what goes into treating a competitive athlete is very much different than what goes into treating, you know, a 45-year-old housewife that's not very active, that's not playing competitive sports every day. And just how that patient is managed is very, very different.
Another thing that I also read in the article, it says that there is no additional risk for someone with a headache in, or no documented risk of them being at a greater risk of concussion or something like that if they have a headache, right? Can you talk about that just a little bit more?
Yeah, and that's a point I always try to make. Just because someone has headache within the world of contact sports, for example, does not necessarily mean that they have concussion. And in fact, this is I see this a lot. In fact, I see this probably weekly where, you know, I have a 16-year-old soccer player, for example, that has headaches that also happens to play soccer, and they're referred to me because everyone just assumes that this individual has migraine. Or I'm sorry, that this individual has concussion, rather. And in fact, a good deal of the time, that is not true. You can have, you know, migraine that's exacerbated by just simply cardiovascular exertion. And if that's the case, this is not an athlete that's at high risk for, you know, long-term chronic neurological impairment because they are not playing through a concussion. They're simply playing through migraine, or they're playing through some other type of headache disorder. You know, the other, you know, misconception is that you can get hit on the head and you can have that hit result in a headache. And again, that headache is not necessarily concussion. There is a type of headache called simply just post-traumatic headache, which is where you get hit in the head, have some tenderness or pain or you know, some sort of a discomfort with palpation directly over the spot where you were hit, no other concussion symptoms whatsoever. You did not have lighter sound sensitivity. You did not have nausea. You did not have cognitive slowing. You did not have dizziness. And that headache is simply just what we refer to as a post-traumatic headache, but not a post-concussive headache. And those headaches, again, are very much different. And that is the type of athlete, if, you know, again, assuming resources are there where they can be observed and monitored very closely, you know, be it through team physicians or athletic trainers, that I would not necessarily require them to shut things down completely, as long as I could monitor them closely and to ensure that that complaint of post-traumatic headache doesn't evolve into anything else more worrisome.
Yeah, one of the comments that I got when I was talking about this was that you can't use headache as the only symptom for a concussion, but then at the same time, we have to be careful that if someone gets hit in the head and a hand has a headache, then we need to take a minute and, you know, maybe even sit them out that game and then reevaluate them the next day, kind of thing. So you need to be careful, but we just have to keep working on finding that balance.
Right, that's true. And that's really where I think you know, a lot of what we do, and whether we want to admit it or not, I think this is just, you know, a practical fact of life. And those of us that are on sidelines, a lot of what we do really comes down to resources. You know, if I have an athlete that's playing football here in Louisville, Kentucky at Central High School, and he comes off the field and tells me, you know, I have a headache, but I don't really have any other concussion symptoms at all. But the only two of us covering that game are the athletic trainer and myself, and we're responsible, you know, for 60 young men that night, that's likely somebody that I'm going to err on the side of caution and pull from the game. However, you know, on the flip side of that, if I have University of Louisville that comes off the sideline, I have 10 student athletic trainers, 5 physicians, you know, a number of professional level personnel, and that athlete's telling me, I have headache. You know, I also happen to have a history of migraine, and this happens occasionally, you know, during the course of a game with exertion. And by the way, I'm not having any other concussion-related symptoms at all. And I check that athlete out closely on the sideline, and they pass every test that I put them through. That might be a context where I would allow them back in But again, monitoring them very closely with the resources that I have on hand. And that would include, you know, reevaluation each time they come off the field to ensure that that I have remained comfortable with them staying in that playing environment. So a lot of these conditions and situations, really, it really comes down to resources and what we have available with regard to monitoring the athlete.
Well, you provided us with a vast amount of information. You know, we've always looked at the migraine component, and I think we'll look at that a little bit closer. Look forward to discussing this with Dr. Padel. You know, one of the things that we have implemented is that when we have an athlete that's coming back post-concussion and that one lingering thing is just the headache, is we started using the Buffalo treadmill test and just having out there walking, you know, just trying to get them moving, which has helped considerably instead of, you know, the athlete just sitting around waiting for that to be asymptomatic with just a headache. So that has helped tremendously. But this is a whole new way to look at migraines, and so appreciate the information you provided us today. Thank you for spending time.
No, absolutely.
And I sure look forward to meeting you at some point.
Yeah, I do as well. And believe me, guys, I really, really appreciate you letting me come on your platform and discussing this, because, you know, both headaches and concussion are both issues that are near and dear to my heart. And this is what I do every day. So I just appreciate the opportunity to visit with you guys about it.
So real quick, have you personally experienced a concussion?
I've experienced two concussions in my life, and I also happen to be a migraine sufferer, believe it or not.
So it is more than just something you're passionate about, but you're physically in that spot to where you understand. So,
and yeah, I'm very fortunate in the sense that my migraines are very few and far between. I have maybe one every other year. However, where my mother and as well as my older sister both had horrific migraines as I was growing up. So this is around a good deal of in my formative years. And to be quite honest, my upbringing and my experience with being around individuals with migraine was one of the reasons, among many, that I went into neurology as a career choice in the first place.
About migraines, I just have a quick question. You know, I've often been heard and taught that, you know, during the migraine period, intense period, to avoid, you know, cheese and citrus and chocolate. Is there any truth to that?
There is. And I will often have my migraine patients keep a headache log or a headache diary. In the beginning, that's something just as simple as, you know, number one, writing down days that they have headache, and number two, to scale those on a scale of 1 to 10, how severe those are. But then what the third thing that I'll have them do is on days that they do have headache, to just take 5 minutes to try to mentally walk backwards throughout the course of their day, to identify anything that could have potentially served as a trigger that they didn't think of at the time. And you'd be surprised how many headache diaries and headache logs have served me well in being able to assist patients in identifying something that could have potentially served as, and indeed we found moving forward, was a trigger for them. Yeah, and that's anything from alcohol to tyramine to MSG to chocolates, and it's very much patient-specific. All those can indeed serve as migraine triggers.
All right. Last thing, Kathy said you're into boxing. She mentioned that, and you said you're looking at D1 athletes right now. You're going to be looking at D1 through D3 athletes. And I don't know that boxing is a Division I sport. Is there something, some of your studies that have related to boxing or, like you said, mixed martial arts?
There are, and I'm glad you asked that, because combat sports are something that I've really found fascinating and I'm involved with significantly here in the state. Of late here, over the last probably 2 years, I've been involved with Dr. Charlie Burnick, who is a neurologist at the Lou Ruvo Center, which essentially is the Cleveland Clinic's outpost in Las Vegas. And he is the primary investigator for the Professional Fighters Brain Health Study. And I've been brought on to that study, you know, essentially as a sub-investigator, helping him incorporate some data sets into the wealth of information that he's already gathering on combat sport athletes, but to also start to obtain some data sets specific to headache. We don't have a wealth of information there yet that's ready to be presented publicly, but probably here within the next 6 to 12 months, we'll have some preliminary data very similar to what I had reported in this paper with regard to collegiate level athletes, but pairing those same sorts of data sets to professional combat sport athletes. So on that, I would say stay tuned. We should have something out on that, you know, by the end of the year or early 2018.
Very good. Very good. All right. That is all I've got for you today. Kathy, anything else?
No, thank you. Thank you for your time and sharing your knowledge with us.
All right. Yeah, thanks so much, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Dr. Seifert, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
They can reach me a number of ways. My office number here in Louisville, Kentucky is 502-899-6782. And I'm also on Twitter. My handle is at NeuroDocTad. That's Neuro, N-E-U-R-O, Doc, D-O-C, Tad, T-A-D.
All right, so you can reach you on Twitter or the office phone there, which again is 502-899-6782, which is also linked in the show notes at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches. And then lastly, Dr. Seifert, is there a here's an opportunity for you to give a shout-out to some of your colleagues that help you with this study and just mention them by name and say thank you.
Oh, absolutely. The co-authors with me on this paper were just invaluable in helping with data collection as well as the preparation of the manuscript, and that's Alicia Sofrinko, Anthony Contos, both at the University of Pittsburgh, Bill Edwards, the head athletic trainer at Western Kentucky University, Keith Webster at the University of Kentucky, Scott Black, team physician at the University of Kentucky, Matthew Lively and Dave Watson at West Virginia, and Scott Livingston, who was formerly at the University of Kentucky, now he's in the military world. And then finally, Robert Callen, who is a neurologist at Stanford. All of those men and women helped tremendously with the work that was put into this manuscript.
Awesome. Very good. Kathy, someone wants to get a hold of you.
They can reach me by email at csupak@houstonmethodist.org.
All right, so if you want to get a hold of,
Yeah, and Twitter, and it's at Kathy Shupak, C-A-T-H-Y-S-U-P-A-K.
All right, so if you want to get a hold of Kathy on Twitter, Kathy, it's S-U-P-A-K. I know she says Shupak, but there's no S in the spelling, just in the pronunciation. All right, and then if you want to reach Dr. Tad Seifert, NeuroDocTad on Twitter, and then obviously I am Mr. Jeremy Jackson on Twitter. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches. And check out the article. Dr. Seifert, where is the article going to be published?
It's currently published online at the journal Headache at their website. Unfortunately, I think that's a paid article currently. But if you reach out to me on Twitter, I'm happy to send over the full PDF of the paper. But then it's also going to be in the print form or the print issue of Headache for the month of June.
All right, so reach out to Dr. Seifert, get that article, read over it, listen to the podcast, hit him up on Twitter with questions. Maybe we'll come back, bring on as part of the guest panel for their second survey, the follow-up one. Again, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/headaches. Dr. Tad Seifert, thank you for being here. Kathy Shupa, thank you for being here. And for the Sports Medicine Broadcast, that is a wrap.